Oh, well, that'll be good enough. Good evening, everybody. So we're going to pick up in the book of Job this evening, having talked a little bit about why bad things happened to good people last week. I'd like to actually get into the book of Job this week and to talk about some bad things that happened to a good man and talk about them from the perspective of his friends, in particular how his friends viewed what Job went through, the reasons why they perceived he had gone through these things, and then to talk about why they are so wrong. I think it's always important whenever we study the book of Job to keep in mind what God has to say about Job in the first chapter, verse number 8. He says to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, one who fears God and shuns evil?" Now, Job is an admirable man for a number of reasons, and as we get into what he has to say about himself and what he's going through next week, I think we can see that this man was due the credit that God gave him. He is a blameless and upright man. He was a man who feared God and shunned evil. And there's a temptation as we look at Job, as we study what he has to say about his circumstances, to view him through the lens of our present-day experience, to view him through the perspective of someone who is on this side of the cross. But when we take into consideration all the things that Job went through and all the things that he endured and, in reality, his limited perspective in many ways, I think we can walk away with a true appreciation for the man Job. But this week we're going to get into what his friends had to say about this terrible set of circumstances. We know that Job was, his livestock was raided by the Sabaeans, and his servants were killed. And as we talked last week, this is, I believe, an example of moral evil. Here were people who intended Job harm, and they committed harm against him. We know that Chaldeans raided his camels and killed all of his servants. Another example of moral evil. You can read all about all this in the first chapter. A windstorm collapses the house where Job's children were having a dinner, and all the children were killed. In the terminology I was using last week, this is an example of natural evil. Here we have a natural disaster, something that is outside of man's control. Lives are taken, and Job and his wife are left behind. And then finally, Job is struck with boils, which is, again, another example of a natural evil. We made a distinction last week between moral evil and natural evil, and these last two, I think, are examples of that latter. I don't know I've never had a boil. I don't know what it feels like. I'm told it's very painful. It's an infection of the hair follicle, I believe. And one is painful, but Job was covered from head to toe with these boils. So he's in a real state. As we look at what happened to Job, we know from the first couple of chapters who was behind all of this. But I want to begin with the question this evening. Did Job know who or what was really behind all of these evils? As I look at the book of Job, it seems to me that what Job has to say, what his three friends have to say, what Elihu has to say, and what God has to say all took place during this time. This was passed down, either orally or in written form. And later on, it was committed to the scripture by some prophet later on down the road. It seems to me, though, that chapters 1 and 2 and the last part of chapter 42 may in fact be something that was inserted at a later time by an inspired prophet. If we take that into consideration, consider that a possibility, I think it's quite likely from the things that Job has to say about what he's suffering and what his friends have to say about his suffering that they had no idea who was really behind all of this. And that's why Job spends all of this time asking that question, why? Why is this happening to me? And as I mentioned last week, when God comes around to answering that question in chapters 38 through 41, he never really tells Job why. In his response, God emphasizes his sovereignty. He emphasizes his power. He talks about he is the one who has hung the stars in the heavens, how he has created the earth to hang on nothing. He has separated the sea from the land. He has set the boundaries for the seas. He's talked about taming the largest animal he's ever created, behemoth. And then he ends up talking about this creature, Leviathan, which sounds a lot like a dragon. And in my estimation, is probably a description of Satan, man's greatest foe. And God's question to Job all along is, can you do any of these things? And God's perspective, his purpose, I think, in asking all these questions is to give Job a sense of humility and to also remind him that we just need to trust in the one who has done all these things. So even though there's not an answer to the question why, it's up to each of us as we go through these things that we don't understand, simply to put our faith and trust in God, who knows all things, who has done all things, and with whom we can safely trust because he will take care of us. We won't always know why, we just need to trust him. So as I look at the book of Job, as I look at what he and his friends and Elihu have to say, I'm not persuaded in any way that they were aware of all the machinations that were going on behind the scenes, all the work of Satan in this respect. And that, I think, is a very helpful perspective because we can relate to that. Sometimes we're placed in situations that we don't understand. And we may even speculate at times that perhaps this is Satan acting as that roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. Perhaps that is what's going on, and yet we don't really know. And if it's true what I'm saying about Job, then I think we can relate to what he has to say about his troubles. So with those things in mind, let's get into what his friends have to say. And as I've already mentioned, his friends really do Job no service in all of their comments. Now, they do a very admirable thing in chapter 2, verses 11 through 13. We're told that they come to Job with the intent of talking with him about all of these things, and they sit for 7 days in silence waiting for Job to speak. This was the custom of the day. It was up to Job to say the first words, and they weren't going to talk until he had had his opportunity to talk first. So they sit there for 7 days in silence, and it would seem that they're sitting there for the purpose of being supportive. And yet, as they get into their comments, it doesn't appear really that they're supportive in any way whatsoever. Because the gist of their argument is that Job is suffering all these evils because he is a sinner. That's what it really all boils down to. One of the things about the book of Job is it's quite repetitive, especially when it comes to the comments of these three friends. They really kind of repeat one another over and over again, albeit in a little different language, but it's basically the same point over and over again. You suffer because you have sinned. That's their diagnosis of Job's situation. Let's take a look at just a few examples. Over in chapter 4, verses 7 through 11, which is the first response to Job from Eliphaz. And in particular, I want you to notice verse number 7. He says, "Remember now, whoever perished being innocent? Or where were the upright ever cut off?" Now you look at that statement, and Eliphaz isn't directly addressing Job and saying, "You know what, Job, you've messed up and that's why you're suffering." He's just sort of throwing this suggestion out there. Well, take a look at your circumstances and compare that with others that you know of. Has an innocent person ever suffered like this? Were the upright ever cut off by God? And his point in those few verses seems to be that God is punishing you. He's punishing you for some sin. We come around to the words of Bildad in chapter 8, verses 2 through 7. I'll just summarize those few verses. Basically, Bildad says the same thing. You must have sinned. Otherwise, God is unjust for what he has done. God is punishing you for your sin. And if he's not punishing you, then it's unjust or unfair what he has done to you. And if you go later to verse number 20, Bildad says, "Behold, God will not cast away the blameless, nor will he uphold the evildoers." Once again, hey Job, God doesn't do this to good people. He doesn't allow these things to happen to the righteous. He doesn't cast away the blameless. He doesn't uphold the evildoer. Come on, Job, can't you see this? Can't you see? Zophar, in chapter 20, verses 20 through 29. In those first few verses, 20 through 26, Zophar talks about the plight of the wicked. And just to summarize, he says, the wicked do not know peace. They will be left without food. Distress comes on him because he trusts in himself. God executes wrath on him while he eats. There is no escape. And it just goes on and on. But let's notice verses 27 through 29. The heavens will reveal his iniquity. And he's talking about the wicked. And the earth will rise up against him. The increase of his house will depart, and his goods will flow away in the day of his, and that's God's, wrath. This is the portion from God for a wicked man, the heritage appointed to him by God. Now, verse 28, he's indirectly talking about Job, isn't he? What has happened to Job? His goods have departed. His livestock has been raided. His camels have been raided. This would have been the greater measure of his wealth in those days. Once again, Zophar is saying, hello, Job. These sorts of things don't happen to the righteous. God doesn't do these things to good people. And essentially what you have going on in the part of Job's friends is they're doing a little bit of reverse engineering. And this is no insult to the engineers who are in the audience this evening, because reverse engineering is a very helpful process. But what they're doing is they're working backwards. They're working from the premise that evil only falls upon those who do evil. Evil has fallen upon you, Job, therefore you must have done evil. So they're looking at the results in Job's life, and they're working their way backwards to this conclusion that Job must be an evil man. That's why this has happened. In the process, they're ignoring all the evidence that they have seen. And there's a couple of times where they even acknowledge that they thought Job was a good guy. But obviously, that can't be the case, because no good man would have all these things happen to him. So that's the gist of what they have to say. But they take it a couple steps further. Not only do they blame Job, they also blame his children. Let's go to chapter 5. Let's look at verses 1 through 4. This is the second chapter of Eliphaz's comments. Chapter 5, verses 1 through 4. Verse 1. Call out now, is there anyone who will answer you? And to which of the holy ones will you turn? For wrath kills a foolish man, and envy slays a simple one. Once again, Eliphaz is indirectly accusing Job of being foolish and simple. Verse 3, I have seen the foolish taking root, but suddenly I cursed his dwelling place. His sons are far from safety. They are crushed in the gate, and there is no deliverer. Essentially, Eliphaz is saying, your sins have killed your children. Your children are responsible in part for what has taken place. Eliphaz includes the children of the foolish to support his point. Now, if you go over to chapter number 8, verse number 4, Bildad connects this together, connects Job's punishment together with the conduct of his children. He says in verse 4, if your sons have sinned against him, he has cast them away for their transgression. This is one of the many reasons why Job ultimately looks at his friends and says to them, you are miserable comforters. Because not only is he accused of some sin, it's also implied that his children may, in fact, be guilty of sin as well. Now, if we think back to chapter number 1, verses 4 through 5, what do we know about Job's customary practice? What did he do of a morning? He offered sacrifices for his children, right? In case they had committed some sin. Now, I bring that up because comparing what we have seen so far to what we know about Job from chapter 1, verse 8, what we know about the intercession he made on the part of his children in chapter 1, verses 4 and 5, these accusations are inaccurate. They're unfair and they're unjust. But these men aren't done yet. They go even a little bit deeper than those accusations. In chapter number 4, verses 2 through 6, Eliphaz criticizes Job. He says to Job, "You know what? You've helped others in bad situations, and now when the time comes for you to face adversity, you are wilting in the face of difficult times." Chapter 4, beginning in verse number 2, he says, "If one attempts a word with you, will you become weary? But who can withhold himself from speaking? Surely you have instructed many, and you have strengthened weak hands. Your words have upheld him who was stumbling, and you have strengthened the feeble knees. But now it comes upon you, and you are weary. It touches you, and you are troubled. Is not your reverence, your confidence, and the integrity of your ways your hope?" Eliphaz is saying to Job, "You've helped others, and now when the time comes for you to face adversity, you're shrinking in the face of it. You can't help yourself." Not only is Job failing to meet the test according to his friends, he's also living in denial of what they believe is at the root of all this. In chapter 11, verses 4 through 6, and I know we're jumping around quite a bit, but I'm just trying to get a few of the salient points from what these guys have to say over the course of, 20 chapters or thereabouts. In chapter 11, verses 4 through 6, Zophar says, "Job, you're living in denial." Verse 4, "For you have said, 'My doctrine is pure, and I am clean in your eyes.' But oh, that God would speak and open his lips against you, that he would show you the secrets of wisdom, for they would double your prudence. Know therefore that God exacts from you less than your iniquity deserves." That first statement in verse 4, and we'll get into this more next week, but Job has been claiming all along that he can't account for why these things have happened to him. He looks at his life and he says, "You know what, I've committed sins, but nothing that warrants this. I'm not an evil person." Zophar comes back and says, "We hear what you're saying. You're presenting yourself as a pure person. You're trying to convince us that you are blameless and upright." Then he says in verse number 5, "Oh, that God would answer you." In other words, God needs to put you in your place, Job. He needs to put you in your place. And if he would, Zophar says, that would double your prudence. And then the final thing he says in verse number 6, this is just astounding to me. "Know therefore that God exacts from you less than your iniquity deserves." How does he know? I mean, he doesn't even know what sin Job has committed, and yet he's looking at his wealth robbed, he's looking at his children killed, he's looking at this man who is covered from head to foot in boils, and he says, "You deserve a whole lot more." I mean, the lack of mercy and grace is just astounding in this situation. So Zophar is accusing Job of living in denial, and the harsh judgment, the severity of judgment is just almost hard to express. Eliphaz over in chapter 15, verses 1 through 6, is saying much the same thing. But let's get over to this next point here. Job is defying conventional wisdom. So you've helped others, but you can't help yourself. You're living in denial. And the greatest error, it seems to me, that in their estimation is, Job is questioning what has become a well-understood worldview, a well-understood perspective that's been handed down from generation to generation. Let's look at the words of Bildad for a moment over in chapter number 8, verses 8 through 10. And I think that this really captures this idea quite clearly. Chapter 8, verses 8 through 10. These are the words of Bildad. Bildad challenges Job, "For inquire, please, of the former age, and consider the things discovered by their fathers. For we were born yesterday and know nothing, because our days on earth are a shadow. Will they not teach you and tell you and utter words from their heart?" When you look at this and you compare it with other passages, and I've got a couple more listed up there, chapter 15 and chapter 20. I won't take the time to turn over to either one of those. When you put all these together, basically what Bildad is saying is, what we've presented to you has been well understood by our forefathers. It's been passed down. Evil people receive suffering. If you're bad, God is going to punish you. And by challenging that, by living in denial, by saying, wait, this just doesn't make any sense, Job, you're running against the grain of what has become an accepted point of view. This is wisdom, Job. Accept it. Embrace it. And by not doing this, Job is just being stiff-necked, rebellious, however you want to put it, stubborn. And this got me to thinking, why? Why had this become conventional wisdom? Why is it that Bildad and Eliphaz and Zophar are all telling Job, go back and talk to the old people. They'll tell you that this is true. Well, the book of Job, this conversation between Job and his three friends and Elihu and God, takes place probably just a few centuries after the flood. In fact, we have a couple of references to the worldwide flood in the book of Job. Chapter 12, verse number 15 is one, but the one I want to focus in on is chapter 22, verses 15 through 17. Job 22, 15 through 17. It's my persuasion that the reason why these men thought this way is because they were interpreting the worldwide flood as God's judgment, God's punishment of the evil, and this was setting a standard, if you will, for subsequent generations. In verse number, 15. Let's see, who is this? Is this Eliphaz? Yes, Eliphaz says, "Will you keep to the old way which wicked men have trod, who were cut down before their time, whose foundations were swept away by a flood? They said to God, 'Depart from us. What can the Almighty do to us?'" And that should be an us there, not a them. Verse 18, "Yet he filled their houses with good things, but the counsel of the wicked is far from me." Now, verses 17 and 18 are a little confusing, and I'll tell you what I think he means by this in just a moment. But I want you to notice in verses 15 and 16, Eliphaz cites the flood as a blueprint for how God handles wicked people. Here you've got rebellious people who God destroyed with a flood. Evil begets suffering. Eliphaz uses the flood as the example. Now, in verses 17 and 18, Eliphaz is being a little sarcastic. And if you go back to chapter 21 and you read verses 7 through 16, you'll see why he's being sarcastic. He's basically quoting Job back to him in a very sarcastic way. Yes, oh yeah, the wicked prosper. Look at how they prosper. God wiped them out with a flood. That's essentially what he's saying in verse 18. So here's Job having this experience, which his friends believe is caused by evil that has gone unacknowledged, that Job is denying. And in his denial, Job is essentially resisting what has become a conventional outlook on suffering following the flood. But it's a point of view that actually has continued on. Who's heard of karma before? Karma is a Far Eastern worldview, perspective, religious idea. And just to simply sum up karma, karma basically means that like deeds lead to like effects. A good action creates good karma, as does good intent. A bad action creates bad karma, as does bad intent. And isn't that what these three men are saying about Job? Your bad actions, your bad intent have created this bad situation. The Mahabharata, which is a Hindu religious book, says, "Happiness comes due to good actions. Suffering results from evil actions. By actions, all things are obtained. By inaction, nothing whatsoever is enjoyed." Happiness comes due to good actions. Suffering results from evil actions. These three men are essentially espousing an early form of what we would call karma. And just to prove that point, consider what Eliphaz says. We've already read this back in chapter 4, verses 7 through 9. "Remember now, whoever perished being innocent. Or where were the upright ever cut off? Even as I have seen, those who plow iniquity and sow trouble reap the same. By the blast of God they perish, and by the breath of his anger they are consumed." My appreciation for books like Job and Ecclesiastes has grown a lot in the last few years because I recognize that these men were wrestling with issues that have persisted to this day. I mean, I've seen on people's news feeds, on Facebook, them espousing a belief in karma. Christians, no less. If we're not careful, this sort of thinking can creep into our heads. How many of you have seen something awful happen to a person and you have thought, well, they're just getting what they deserve? You ever thought that? That could be karma. A suggestion of karma. Now, as we're going to look at here in just a moment, maybe I should just go ahead and get over to this slide. There is a definite cause and effect relationship between sin and its consequences. But let's just back up for a moment and take into consideration this idea of karma, that suffering is the result of evil deeds. Well, that can't be the case with Job, can it? What do we know about Job? Well, chapter 1, verse number 8. He's blameless, he's upright, he fears God, he shuns evil. What happened to Job did not happen as a result of some evil he did. That's as plain as day. But how would you reconcile the idea of karma with what Paul teaches in Galatians 6, 7, and 8? I talked about this last week. Do not be deceived. God is not mocked. For whatever a man sows, that he will also reap. For he who sows to the flesh will of the flesh reap corruption. Some people will say that that's Paul teaching a type of karma. But it seems to me that the idea of karma is much more general. A person who generally lives an evil life is going to encounter suffering later on. Once again, it's a very general suffering. Whereas what I think Paul is talking about are specific consequences for specific actions. And believe it or not, that's a little different than the concept of karma. If you don't pay your taxes for 10 years, you will end up in prison or something else. That's not karma, that's just cause and effect. You've done something wrong, you're going to pay consequences for that action, for that choice. It's just going to happen. But karma is, it seems to me, something much more general. Here's a person who's lived a very evil life, and they suffer in the future because of it. So I see the two as being quite different because of a comparison between general and specific. I also think that karma is a false doctrine, not just because it doesn't fit with what we see about Job, but It just doesn't fit with the model that God offers when it comes to suffering. Because one of the results of suffering is joy. Joy can come from suffering. I mean, what does James say in James chapter 1, verse number 2? Count it all joy when you fall into various trials. Philippians chapter 2, verses 17 and 18, Paul says, yes, and if I am being poured out as a drink offering on the sacrifice and service of your faith, be glad and rejoice with me. Be glad and rejoice with me. This suffering, this sacrifice that I'm making on your part, on the Lord's part, is not an occasion for sadness, for mourning. It's an occasion for joy, because joy can come from suffering and sacrifice. It's the lesson that Jesus teaches us on the cross in Hebrews chapter 12, verses 1 and 2. That out of suffering can come great joy. Who for the joy set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. So karma just doesn't fit with what we see happening in the book of Job or anywhere else in the Bible for that matter. But there's more to what Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar have to say. There's more wrong with their diagnosis of the situation. Let's go over to chapter 5 for a moment. Take a look at verses 17 through 27. We won't read all 10 of those verses. But I want you to notice what Eliphaz says in verse 17. He says, behold, happy is the man whom God corrects. Therefore, do not despise the chastening of the Almighty. Now, that sounds a lot like what the writer of Hebrews says over in Hebrews chapter 12, right? That the chastening of the Lord produces the peaceable fruit of righteousness. It sounds a lot like it. It sounds a lot like what we read in some of the Proverbs as well, that the one who receives correction is loved by God, that God's treating him as, or her, as a son or daughter. But then Eliphaz goes to list in verses 18 through 26 all the blessings that come as a result of receiving the chastening of the Lord and being a righteous person. And the implication in these 10 verses is, if you repent of your sin, Job, God will bless you, because the righteous always receive good from God. Now, you can look at the statements of Eliphaz from a post-crucifixion perspective, and you can see truth in what he's saying. And yet we have to keep in mind the premise that he's operating from, which is, if you do bad, you suffer. If you do good, God blesses you. But that's not how this works. We know that. It's what we talked about last week. We talked about Matthew chapter 5, verse 45. God makes his sun rise on the evil and on the good, and sends his rain on the just and on the unjust. God's blessings come regardless of whether or not you're a righteous or an unrighteous person. God does good things even for the wicked. Let's go over to chapter 8, verses 5 through 7, and look at the words of Bildad here real quick, because I think Bildad gives us an even better idea of what exactly they're after. In Job chapter 8, verses 5 through 7, Bildad says this: if you would earnestly seek God and make your supplication to the Almighty, if you were pure and upright, surely now he would awake for you and prosper your rightful dwelling place. Though your beginning was small, yet your latter end would increase abundantly. Now, I want you to think for a moment about what exactly Bildad is suggesting. He's saying, if you seek out God, if you come back to the Lord, he is going to prosper your way. And notice that seventh verse. Though your beginning was small. What beginning is he talking about? Well, I think he's talking about Job's life before all this happened. Job was an incredibly wealthy man. Incredibly wealthy. Bildad says, you may have been wealthy before, but if you're a righteous man, God's really going to bless you then. Your beginning was small, but your latter end would increase abundantly. I don't have time to get into Zophar's statement in chapter 11, verses 13 through 20, but it's a good example of this as well. I bring this up because not only are these men wrestling with the concept of karma, they're also wrestling with something that's become very popular in our day and age as well. We call it the prosperity gospel. Some people call it prosperity theology. The prosperity gospel essentially teaches that financial blessing and physical well-being are always the will of God for the righteous, and that faith, positive speech, and donations to religious causes will increase one's material wealth. That's essentially what these men are saying to Job. If you will just admit that you're wrong, if you will seek righteousness, God is going to bless you, and he's going to bless you super abundantly. And what Bildad has to say in chapter 8, verses 5 through 7, is, in essence, a statement of the very core of the prosperity theology. Come to God, and God is going to bless you and bless you abundantly. So as we look at the book of Job, as we consider what these men say to Job, how they diagnose his problem, and what they prescribe as a solution, I think we see some ideas that are still present today. It makes the book of Job incredibly relevant. Now, I haven't seen any hands, so I just kept going. So, I tricked you there, didn't I? Are there any questions or comments? Because I'm just about out of time here. Any questions or comments? Anybody have anything they want to say? All right, well, let me just leave you with this question. I was going to throw this open for discussion, but I'm out of time. It's just something to think about. These men are obviously wrestling with the evils that come in this world. And I think it's worth thinking about, and I plan to get into this a little bit more in week number 4. Why do we struggle so much to come to terms with evil? Why is this so hard for us to deal with? It's a question that's worth thinking about. I believe we've already seen some of the reasons why in Job's friend's statements, and I think we're going to see some more reasons why next week. But just, I'll leave you with that question. Think about it this next week. We'll get into what Job has to say next week, Lord willing. Thank you for your attention, and look forward to being with you next week if God is willing.